Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series titled Supporting Adolescents and Young Adults in Managing Type 1 Diabetes. I am Diana Isaacs, an endocrine clinical pharmacy specialist and the CGM program coordinator at the Cleveland Clinic Diabetes Center in Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi, I'm Natalie Bellini. I'm an endocrine nurse practitioner specializing in diabetes management with University Hospitals in Cleveland, Ohio.
So today, we will discuss strategies to empower young adults with the skills and resources necessary to effectively manage type 1 diabetes and maintain a healthy lifestyle. And to discuss more of this, we are joined by Dr. Julia Blanchett, a nurse scientist and diabetes care and education specialist at University Hospitals Cleveland Medical Center for Diabetes and Obesity. She's also a clinical assistant professor of medicine at Case Western Reserve University, also in Cleveland, Ohio. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Blanchett.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's begin. Can you talk to us a little bit about the latest advancements in insulin delivery options for people with type 1 that can especially help the young adult population?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we're all very excited about the recent approval of Omnipod 5, which is an automated insulin delivery system. We're all also very excited about the recent FDA approval of Tidepool Loop, and we are still excited about Tandem's Control-IQ. And so these are all automated insulin delivery systems that are FDA approved that really help improve time and range and kind of take some of that burden for self-management off of the young adult who has a really varying schedule.
So for those people that don't know, can you tell us what AID is?
Absolutely. I should have started with that. So AID is an automated insulin delivery. So essentially, they use their algorithm-driven insulin pump and continuous glucose monitor combined devices where there is an algorithm that looks kind of at what the glucose levels are doing, and it adjusts insulin accordingly.
So a patient who uses something like that, someone who chooses a device like this, what do they still have to do?
Yeah, so of course, there's still some self-management tasks involved, like entering in carbohydrates, and also changing infusion sets and filling with insulin, as well as just attending to the device to make sure that there's no issues with continuous glucose monitoring connections, also to make sure that the infusion sites are working and that there's no issues with delivery.
And can you speak about some of the other options too? So I know automated insulin delivery has been revolutionary, but not every person, for whatever reason, is going to use a pump or wants to use an insulin pump. So kind of what other innovations have we seen lately?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So especially for young adults, some young adults don't like wearing multiple devices, but still love wearing continuous glucose monitoring because, you know, that's only one piece of adhesive, one little extra thing to wear on the body instead of also wearing an infusion set or a pod for an insulin pump. And the continuous glucose monitoring takes away the burden of needing to finger stick check and gives more information when, you know, they're really living these variable lifestyles. Some are working in brand new jobs, adapting to work life, right, as a young adult. And then others are on college campuses or at graduate school or have families. And there's just a lot of factors that impact glucose. So being able to see everything and connect those dots, instead of worrying about what's happening when you can just get kind of a snapshot, which you typically do with the finger stick checks, it can be really, really helpful and empowering to this population.
Yeah, I mean, CGM has been just transformative. And then we've also, like, fortunately, we've had inhaled insulin and there's connected insulin pens and pen caps. So it's been really nice to see all the innovative technology become available.
I actually have quite a few young adults that love using smart pens as well because it gives the ability to track insulin, use a bolus calculator, and then give the data back to work with the healthcare team to really kind of solve some problems instead of just, you know, not being able to track those elements. But the bolus calculator feature in particular is a fan favorite.
For sure. Yeah, I just had actually a young adult yesterday say how that really helped to prevent him from stacking insulin. So
yeah.
And for those of you that don't know, a smart pen or an integrated pen, depending on who's calling it, what at what time, actually helps that person, they enter their carbohydrates, whether it's servings or grams, and then the blood glucose or interstitial fluid glucose, whatever the glucose reading is, and then creates a calculated number. So someone might say, I'm having 22 grams of carbohydrate, my blood sugar is 168, and the app would suggest a number like 2.6 or 3.8, depending on their ratios, so that there is a dose that can be given and then tracked. So over time, that insulin is absorbed and used, and you can then safely give insulin again and say, this is how much is still kicking around. And it reduces that stacking that we're all afraid of, right?
Right, because if someone's glucose level is high a couple hours after eating, it'll tell them the safe amount to take versus if they would take their full dose at that time, some of the old insulin still working in their body and it could cause them to drop too low. So yeah, so speaking about that, you started to go into this a little bit, but I'm curious, what are some of the biggest challenges that you see with adolescents and young adults with managing their condition, type 1 diabetes?
So I could talk all day about all of the challenges, but to start with, related to technology. So first of all, when you are transitioning to independent diabetes self-management, that comes along with a lot of new responsibilities. It comes along with new stressors, new sources of anxiety, and just new burden that your family or your caretakers were helping you, a lot of individuals, at least not everyone, balance previously. So with that, when you're using diabetes technology, it can become really burdensome to even figure out how to get supplies. It can become burdensome to change your pump site and to figure out a routine when you can integrate all of your self-management tasks, like changing out your sites or your sensors. But also there is the fear of not fitting in and kind of trying to figure out your own identity at that phase as well. So some struggle with trying to figure out, like, who am I as an individual living with diabetes? Where's my place? How am I existing, here in the society without diabetes? Like, what do I mean? There's a lot of this self-identity formation that goes on developmentally in that period. So that really complicates technology use and then just adapting to independent diabetes self-management in general at that time. So I can keep going about technology, or I can kind of go into some of the other barriers. What do you guys want to hear
about? I'd love to hear about some of the other barriers as well.
Okay, awesome. So, the one that I'm particularly interested in is this financial stress that emerges a lot of times for the first time during young adulthood, not as much adolescence. It's, when the individual with diabetes really becomes aware of everything that goes into obtaining diabetes supplies and medications, and also into just caring for yourself, your own well-being, and taking care of your health, all of the finances that go into that. And it's a struggle for young adults to figure out how to get what they need to survive, but also how to fit in with others and figure out how to balance your expendable income that's left over after budgeting in for all of these things related to diabetes. So it can be really distressing. It can be, a lot of people feel kind of hopeless about their financial situation when they go through this experience. So that's one of the pieces that I'm really focused on, is how to help with this financial stress. Obviously, I can't magically solve financial stress as a clinician or a researcher, but figuring out ways to intervene is really important. And then along with the financial stress comes the navigating the healthcare system. That in itself is a barrier to care.
That's really interesting. Are there any certain transition times that are especially hard, like maybe going away to the college for the first time, or like other times that you've seen that are especially kind of more challenging?
Yeah, so when one leaves home for the first time, whether it's going to college or just moving out from their parents' house, that is a time when figuring out how to get supplies, get food even, and everything you need and living on your own and the finances that go along with that and diabetes first emerge as a really stressful issue. So the age that it happens at may be different depending on the individual. And then for some, it happens if they go to college, it may happen after they graduate from college and really move out on their own for the first time and aren't living in these like dormitory style type houses and have less financial support from their parents or from their college.
And I think, too, there is something to be said for insurance, right? In the United States, people can stay on their parents' insurance plan till the age of 26, which is why you're mentioning, you know, through college. A lot of people don't go to college. The majority of Americans don't ever go to college. And I think those people that are going into the workforce have to make some decisions earlier, right? They are not as financially dependent on their parents for as long, and they need to make insurance decisions. And so when you go to pick insurance in the United States, you know, and you have a budget and you're getting your first apartment maybe, and you're living with a couple of friends and whatever, and maybe you're not making great money at the time yet because you're brand new to the workforce, choosing a more expensive plan that might have better diabetes coverage is a real challenge, because that's like, okay, I'm giving up maybe eating out two nights a month and doing this or that when you have to pick something based on, you know, something that people shouldn't have to think about at 18 or 19 years old, right? Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, and how do we address that?
Yeah, so it's obviously a very large problem to tackle, but so for a lot of individuals, even those that have parents that have insurance, they may not be able to stay on their parents' insurance until age 26. So I really want to emphasize that for individuals that are in the Medicaid system, especially, it's very state dependent on when they need to go on their own insurance plan. And that a lot of times is a pivotal moment when one realizes that they are in charge of their own healthcare finances and their health insurance. So as you talked about, though, when you go into the workforce, if you have a choice for insurance plan, or, you know, whenever you have to go onto your own plan for the first time, a lot of times people pick the cheapest option. Actually, if you were to go to an insurance salesperson through the marketplace, I've heard stories of younger people, you know, younger adults with diabetes being advised to buy a cheaper plan because the people selling it to them don't even understand what really benefits them the most in that plan. So it's a really big problem that young adults end up with these less costly plans that end up having higher copays, high deductibles, and higher out-of-pocket maximums. So in the end, if something catastrophic happens, or if you even just need to get a lot of lab testing, which we know is important for a lot of young adults who may be seeing complications emerge for the first time, for example, those are all situations in which someone can end up in a bad financial situation simply by picking a plan that seemed to be the most affordable. So I think you asked too about what do we do to help these people, right? So unfortunately, there's not a lot of resources out there right now to help individuals choose plans that are catered to their own healthcare needs. So one of the things I say is, you know, there are resources available for people with diabetes from verified sources online. Some of the nonprofit organizations that we usually refer a lot of patients to for diabetes resources, like JDRF has some resources, actually very comprehensive written resources, Beyond Type 1 and Beyond Type 2, Diatribe. And then there are government-sponsored websites as well that have a lot of just kind of the basic information. But if you really do want to learn more about what you should be aware of as a person with diabetes, I highly recommend some of those written resources from diabetes organizations, because, you know, it's just so hard. You want to go ask your peers or your parents for help, but a lot of times they may not even understand your individual situation and what works best for you. So that's kind of the options right now. I happen to be looking a lot at this issue and working with individuals in the community to figure out how we can create resources that actually help individuals with making some of these decisions.
I know you and your team are working on a financial toolkit, and I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, so this all started with my dissertation research, where I looked at kind of just describing what financial stress is in young adults from across the United States living with diabetes. And I found that financial stress levels on average are moderate or high in 18 to 25 year olds living with type 1 diabetes. And they experience high levels of diabetes distress and higher A1Cs and financial stress has negative impacts on diabetes distress, diabetes-related quality of life, and A1C, which all sounds like, you know, common sense. But of course, I had to show it with the data because it didn't exist. So that was kind of my first step. And then during my postdoc fellowship, which was sponsored by the Association of Diabetes Care and Education Specialists, ADCES, and the Certification Board for Diabetes Care and Education, CBDCE, I worked with my mentors, Drs. Michelle Lichtman and Nancy Allen at the University of Utah to work with a community advisory board with people with different perspectives from across the type 1 diabetes emerging adult space to develop this micro video toolkit series in which young adult peers living with type 1 diabetes themselves talk about different aspects of health insurance, finances, and the emotional impact and how to advocate for oneself. So now I'm working on expanding that toolkit further and involving more perspectives in the next steps. So we are involving some insurance payers from expansion and non-expansion states for Medicaid, in addition to making sure we very intentionally include the voices of more racially and ethnically diverse young adults living with diabetes, as well as those who have been on different types of insurance plans. Whereas the first community advisory board, we only had two young adults living with type 1 diabetes, and then we had like some financial educator and parent perspectives.
Wow, and Natalie
was actually, Natalie was actually one of the healthcare provider perspectives on that community advisory board, so.
Yes, I was. So can we talk a little bit more about how do you fund such research like this? This sounds like a very large project.
Yes, it is very large. So, you know, what I did first is I did an observational descriptive study. That was the first step, and that was very low cost. So you can do that. You can get volunteers for filling out online surveys related to a topic that is of hot interest in the community, like financial stress, for very low cost. Then the second step was to do this pilot work. So I had a smaller grant, which was about $100,000, to fund a one-year study where we had a smaller community advisory board. I had the young adults themselves, the peer young adult leaders, film themselves. So the videos were very low to no cost. And then when we piloted it in the trial, we only had 40 participants in that trial. So there's obviously some cost to that, but it was as low cost as we could keep it to just kind of understand, is this community developed type of micro video resource useful in this population? We found it was. We found that these young adults that participated in the pilot were very engaged. They wanted more of it, and they wanted an awesome resource available to them and their peers. So that is what kind of led into the next level of funding, where we're doing this much larger scale, and we really are trying to make sure we have a lot of different perspectives and really a final product. So part of that was collaborating with community organizations. So we're collaborating with the Diabetes Link, and we're basically kind of, I won't say resource sharing, but we kind of are resource sharing, because they have some really exciting work going on themselves, and this is in parallel with it. So they're actually going to be able to help us once we have a final product that we test in a randomized control trial, larger scale, and then tweak a little bit if needed. They're actually going to have a place to keep this resource and maintain it for the community to access for free. So to get all of the funding for that, it did cost a lot of money, but essentially we had the data that supported how much this resource is needed. And we kind of, you know, we did the descriptive study, then we did the pilot, and now we're going larger scale. Those are kind of the steps that I was trained to take to get funding like this. But also these community partnerships definitely helped because it really is elevating the need for this type of resource when the community is saying they need it.
I was going to say, well, this is really, really cool.
Right.
I'm curious, like, it sounds like it's so needed. How are you going to assess it? Like, what are the outcomes that you're looking for when you assess this product or this toolkit?
Yeah, so in the randomized control trial, we will be looking at financial stress levels. There's something called the Personal Financial Well-Being Scale. I've used it since my dissertation. It's 8 questions. It's very quick, and it's used pretty frequently to look at financial stress across, you know, consumers, but now it's also being used in healthcare and with conditions like diabetes more often. Then we're also looking at health insurance literacy. So there's something called the Health Insurance Literacy Measure, the HELM, and it was developed initially to look at how consumers were able to understand insurance and enroll and in the Affordable Care Act health plans, but now it's being utilized across kind of all populations to understand, do people actually understand insurance, and can they really enroll in it in a way that's beneficial to their health and financial situation. Then we'll also be looking at transition readiness using the READY instrument. I'm still asking for permission on that one, so won't do it without permission. And then we're looking at diabetes-specific quality of life, diabetes distress, and then we will also be looking at A1C and then time in range for those who have time in range available. So we'll be looking at those measures before the intervention, right after the intervention period's over. So they'll have access to whatever the community advisory board develops with us, whatever toolkit it is, it'll be online. They'll have access for a month. They'll get another measure there, and then we'll do a 6-month measure and a 12-month measure. So we'll look over time, are there differences in all of these outcomes that are so important to managing diabetes and thriving as a young adult?
That's awesome. Yeah, I was wondering if you're going to look at like time and range and A1C. So I'm really glad to hear that you're doing that. I'm curious. So, I mean, like we've heard a lot of news recently about pharma companies, you know, majorly cutting the prices of insulin, which is obviously the cost is a big concern for many people. How do you think that might affect your current work in terms of this financial, you know, this financial research? If, you know, hopefully this is, we'll continue to see that the costs do continue to go down for insulin.
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. So as you know, as both of you know, part of the reason I started digging into this area, like how my research area came to be, was really that I was looking at the transition from pediatric to adult diabetes care and how to really support that process, how to smooth it over, how to make sure there are less gaps in care. And then I experienced a personal experience where I went to the pharmacy to pick up my insulin, and unbeknownst to me, my insurance plan had changed to a high deductible. And that experience in itself really changed the whole path of my research, right? But my insurance, you know, because I had this high deductible, I had to pay $800 for my insulin. I was able to just get it for $35. Had I been able to go get it for $35, I don't think I would have ever dug this deep into this area of work. So, you know, in a way, I'm glad this happened, because what I'm finding is, I think regardless of insurance plan type or how much insulin itself is, young adults in general are not financially stable. They do not have high financial independence. And there's a lot of, you know, disruptions in finances during this emerging adult developmental stage, regardless of if you have diabetes or not. But when you have a chronic condition, there's a lot more complexities. And then the health insurance literacy piece and the healthcare navigation piece come into play as well, complicating everything that impacts self-management. So I'm thrilled that people will be able to access insulin for lower costs. And, you know, what has happened in the past for those that haven't been able to access it has been really sad and really has created, you know, in some of my qualitative data that I've looked at, it has created this fear of not being able to access insulin in the young adult age group. So maybe that fear will slightly diminish, but I think people are still going to experience this financial stress, which comes off as a stressor. And we know that stress itself has negative impacts on self-management outcomes. So I don't think this financial instability piece is going away anytime soon, although I do think that we may see some changes in this like fear of loss of insurance and fear of not being able to access insulin. So
I think that's a really good point, because even with lower cost insulin, most insulin requires a prescription. So people still need to figure out how to get their medical care paid for. And then, of course, when it comes to technology, that has a cost to it. CGM pumps, connected pens. I mean, those are all things that they can be expensive. So,
well, expensive and also stressful, because, you know, all of the steps you have to take to navigate the healthcare system and then advocate for yourself to get the appointments you need, rearrange your schedule to get to your appointments, or even to go into a virtual appointment can be a stress on these young adults. And then figuring out how to get everything from the pharmacy or your medical supplier, like all of these pieces that are part of the process can come off as stressors. So,
and I think with young adults or emerging adults, that there's already so many stressors, right? Like you said, there's the psychosocial, there's the change in living conditions, there's the change in whether you're moving to go get a job, whether you're going to stay at home and start at, you know, working from home, but your relationship with your family changes, your living environment changes, your economics, how much money you can bring in or not bring in changes. And we have a handful of patients right now who are struggling with, their parents are either separating or something's happening and their parents can't keep them on their insurance any longer because of financial stress of their own, right? And so they're kind of thinking, okay, I'm going to be okay until I'm 26, which is the law. You can stay on your parents' insurance until you're 26 in the United States, but they don't have to let you. And sometimes they truly can't afford it. So then what do you do, right? I think there's a lot of the technology has come so far, and yet the stressors for being a young emerging adult with a disease like type 1 diabetes is immense. It's immense.
What advice do you have for parents or caregivers to really support their loved ones in managing type 1 diabetes?
So the best thing that my mom did is that she wasn't a helicopter parent, which I know this is coming off as kind of strong advice here, but a lot of what I hear is, you know, these parents are so worried and they care so much about their loved one that, you know, they kind of are a little invasive. And I think, you know, they have access to watch CGM, but doing things like dropping in on Alexa in college to tell someone to check their blood sugar is, in my opinion, that can be really stressful when you still have a parent caregiver that is trying that hard to intervene with your care. So the best thing my mom did is she let me do my thing, but then she still offered support. She said, you know, I'm here for you. If you need anything, I can help you order your supplies. I can help you. I can be on the phone with you when you call to order your supplies from EdgeCark for the first time by yourself. I can be on the phone with you when you have to call insurance to see why they're no longer covering your NovLog. She did all of those things for me, and that was amazing. But I think, you know, parents, be there for each other, you know, lean on each other for support. There's so many ways to connect with other parents going through the same thing right now, to kind of help you navigate like what may work for one kid versus another, because everyone's so different in how they want their parents to support them. But definitely just asking your loved one as well, how can I support you, can be a really beautiful thing. So
if I were a parent with a child that had, or a young adult that had diabetes, where would I go? How would I find another parent? Some of our families have no one. They know no one else.
Yeah, so social media can be a beautiful resource for that. There's some really great Facebook groups. I'm going to give a shout out to the Juice Box Podcast Facebook group. There are so many parents in there, but I've even seen people in there like grandparent caregivers or a sibling that just want to connect with others to learn how to support people with diabetes. And you'll even see a lot of people just sharing their personal stories or their stories about their loved one and how they're kind of coping with that. What I really love about that community is it's not just focused on like the person living with type 1. There's really a big draw to other support people in the space. So I think that can be a really That's one of my favorite resources to recommend to others. But I think, you know, if you have any in-person diabetes events in your area, go to those as well to try to meet other people there. Like JDRF in Cleveland, where I am, actually just hosted their first in-person summit for the first time since the pandemic. So those are starting to come back in person. And there's other events happening as well, hopefully not just in Cleveland, hopefully across the country. So going to those types of events, even if you have an adult child, you know, there is, everyone needs support. There's people like you that are going to those events for support too. So,
yeah. Wow. Well, that's like such great advice. I really like what you said about not being a helicopter parent too, but really supporting the young adult or adolescent. So thank you so much, Dr. Blanchett, for this amazing, amazing discussion.
Wow. What an amazing conversation with Dr. Blanchett.
Yeah.
It was so a handful of things that I took away from that. One, the transition between teenage to adult. And I think you and I, both working in adult endocrine care, we see people coming back after 2 or 3 years of disappearing. Well, where did you go? Well, I went back to primary. I didn't know what to do. I was unsure. I mean, she's really addressing a need that we have seen over the years.
Yeah, it's tough because a lot of times people relocate. I mean, they either they go away to college or they start a job somewhere. And so wherever they had care established may not be where it is. Because I know there are many pediatric endo offices that are taking kids till they're well into their young adulthood. But if people relocate, then it's hard to reestablish care. And the transition going from pediatric to then adult endocrinology isn't always the smoothest either.
No, and we didn't really touch on that much. You know, for a lot of people who bring their children to pediatric care, they can see in one visit a social worker, a dietitian, a pharmacist, an endocrinologist, a nurse practitioner, a PA, whoever all this group is together in one visit. They might be there for a couple of hours, but they get this whole group together.
Yeah.
And they can kind of pick and choose where they need to be seen and what happens in that. And in adult endo, we don't offer that, right? We just really, it's much more of a come for this and then come for this and then come for this. And there's a little bit of support, but not nearly the same as when you're walking in.
Right, not regularly. That is exactly right. Like we sometimes pair the diabetes education with the visit, but it's not a standard practice in adults. And
right.
So that is another major, major difference as well.
And I think the other big thing is there are lots of pediatric endo programs who are creating what they call transition programs, right? We're going to get you to adult. We're going to bridge this because we recognize this as a challenge. And sometimes families don't participate. Sometimes families aren't ready to do that. Sometimes the teenager isn't ready. Sometimes it is recognized as an issue. And I can see where Dr. Blanchett's work may really help that. A young adult, you know, can get online and find videos and use them and watch them and say, wow, that feels like me. That looks like me. I'm worried about insurance. I never thought about having insurance because that's what mom did or dad did. Ordered supplies, you know, decide how many vials of insulin do you need in a month? Things that really, they just go get it.
And I didn't think about what she said about the support, like caregivers, parents, about not being a helicopter parent, but still offering to help and offering that support. And I think too often people have really good intentions, but they become that helicopter parent. It's hard not to when you see that CGM and you see it flying up and the 300 and you're calling your kid. What's going on? What did you eat? What did you do? Did you give your insulin? Did you give it early enough? Are you correcting? And whoa, that's a lot.
Right.
And I could see how if that's what you have, like then you just want to get away and kind of like...
Right. Let it go.
Just let it go.
Right. We're not talking. Right. We're done.
Yeah. And so it's interesting. So I think that was really like interesting advice. And offering support for the caregivers and parents is really important too.
And I think that other side of you can't also, so we don't want a helicopter person. We also don't want it's yours now. Good luck.
Exactly.
Because it takes, it really does take a village, right? So even with our adult patients, we say, do you have a significant other? Bring them to your next appointment.
Yeah.
Who's your most important? It's your best friend. Bring your best friend, your aunt, your cousin, your next door neighbor. Who supports you in your diabetes? Because they need to hear this too. And so I think that parents who also just walk away not even meaningfully, but just say, okay, it's Timmy's turn now, right? Timmy's not ready. We know this, right? So there's that side of it too that becomes a real, how do you find that balance between not being a helicopter and not, and actually keeping the communication with your parents open?
Right. No, the support, right? You cannot just throw the young adult to the wolves. I was also, the financial toolkit's really interesting. And I was thinking, like, obviously type 1 diabetes is one thing, but there's actually a lot of chronic conditions. And any young adult or adolescent who's navigating this transition period, really with any chronic condition that requires medical care, medications, is kind of going through this and would benefit from this type of toolkit. So I'm excited about her work, and I could see it being, you know, broadened to other conditions
as
well.
Absolutely. Just setting up your doctor's appointments, getting to the pharmacy on a regular basis, or even accepting mail, you know, medications. You know, how long can it sit outside? What happens? Can I, you know, all of those little things that the toolkit can just help calm everything down. Right? This is going to be okay. Let us help you direct your care and your medical management outside of that office, I think is going to be, I could see it in all kinds of chronic diseases.
Right. Well, awesome. Thanks so much for the great discussion.
Yes, as always.